proudly student and listener-supported community radio. CIUT 89.5 FM, celebrating 35 years as the sound of your city.
Again, it's a Taylor Report and CIUT. Our guest is Tony Leah. He is a member of Local 222 Unifor. That's GM Oshawa. Very important company, very important portion of the Unifor, the union. It's been through some real sagas recently. And now we have a new one. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Well, I think our listeners, last week we had on the program Sid Ryan. And Sid has been commenting on the crisis going on in your union and the way it's being handled. And I assume he also, people should know, you just go Sid Ryan, you can find him on Facebook and elsewhere commenting about these things. First of all, let's just establish, you have a convention coming up. What's the date?
The Unifor Constitutional Convention opens on August the 8th. It's in Toronto, and it runs for that week, August 8th to 12th.
So what a cloud is shaped over your union because of this business with Jerry Dias. I think everybody now is practically fairly familiar with it. Dias, my memory was he was going to step down and he had designated a successor, but that's all been knocked into a cocked hat. You have a contest now. Who's running?
There are three candidates. Lana Payne, who is the number two elected leader of Unifor nationally, she's the national secretary treasurer, was the third candidate to announce. Scott Doherty, who is or was the executive assistant to Jerry Dias and was handpicked by Dias to be his replacement and initially got the endorsement of the National Executive Board on the recommendation of Dias, is a candidate. And Dave Cassidy, who's the president of Local 444, representing Chrysler or Stellantis, as it's known now, workers in Windsor, has also announced his candidate and said that he didn't believe that the union should continue to follow the process of having the National Executive Board or the top leadership choose the next leader, and that it should be opened up more broadly to the members, or at least the delegates who go to the convention to choose. And it was really Dave Cassidy's announcement that he wasn't going to go along with the managed process that initially opened up this contest. And then, of course, the revelation that there was an investigation into Jerry Dias's behavior really blew the lid off it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, his was the first voice I remember as this first time it hit the papers. But Cassidy's probably at a disadvantage, is he not? I mean, in terms of, you have a union which has been choosing people from within the executive. Sort of that's been the pattern.
That's been the pattern. It's a system that they used to call the Administrative Caucus, and it goes back to Walter Reuther. When Walter Reuther became president of the International UAW, in order to eliminate the left wing of the union, he really strengthened control from the president's office. And he developed this system of making sure that the top leadership were all part of the same ideological group. And it carried on through even after the CAW split from the UAW. That was one of the undemocratic practices that they maintained. And Unifor has maintained it since the merger with the CEP in 2013. So it's been a very longstanding practice, and it's a way of managing things so that you don't let the members have a say, unfortunately. And that's what we're still stuck with.
You have an electoral college.
It is an electoral college type of system.
Buffer, or what they call it.
Because it's only the delegates, the, you know, about 2,000 delegates who go to the convention who actually get to cast votes on behalf of all of the members. But what makes it even more problematic is the role that the staff play. There are a couple of hundred people who are national representatives for the union. They're extremely well paid. I think that their salaries are in the range of $150,000 per year, which is, you know, roughly three times what the average Unifor member earns. And these staff people have been very active in trying to determine who the next leadership people are going to be, the national president and the other top leaders. And they're all out campaigning very hard for their chosen candidate. In most cases, that means either Lana Payne or Scott Doherty. And the staff, of course, they service the locals. They're seen as, you know, important people, and they have a certain amount of sway. And they've been all out there pounding the pavement and, you know, trying to corral delegates for their chosen candidate. And I find that really problematic. If I had my way, I don't think that the staff should have any role in determining the leadership of the union. I think that should be left up to the members and activists in the different locals, because the staff are employees of the union. I think they have a built-in conflict of interest that they've been appointed by the national president. And so to then turn around and allow them to help to determine who the next president is, I don't think that that benefits the union.
The process, talking about the candidates, report that has come down, and it is, of course, very close to your convention, I assume that it's going to have an impact. My understanding is that Lana Payne and Scott Doherty?
Scott Doherty, yes.
Are they in direct exchange over arguments over facts? Because my understanding is that Doherty is denying that the report reflects unfavorably on him, so he says. You've read it, you could say. Are they actually engaging the subject with each other?
Well, maybe not directly with each other, but they certainly are. There's really heated arguments going on about interpretation or the issue. And the key issue that I think affects Doherty is that it's very clear if you read the actual report, and it goes through the how evidence was collected, the testimony of different people, how it was backed up by text messages and emails and so on. And it's very, very clear that once Chris McDonald said that he was going to put a complaint in writing about Dias's behavior in accepting a large amount of money and offering to share it with McDonald, once that complaint was made, there were very strong efforts made to get McDonald to withdraw his complaint. A lot of pressure was put on him. He was subject to incredible pressure. And a lot of that pressure was delivered by Scott Doherty on behalf of Jerry Dias. That's what the report says, their conclusion is.
So he's arguing against the report. Did he try to?
He is. And he just flatly says, no, he didn't try to pressure Chris McDonald.
But by the way, I think I saw him quoted in the papers, and I think this is accurate. He said, I would have handled it differently.
Absolutely. On that point,
it being, I think he meant the arrival of a bag of money and it's being given, and whether or not, what should there have been a complaint about it, or should they have simply talked it over? Am I right?
You're right. Doherty's position, and he has said this now quite clearly and publicly, is that there should not have been any public revelation of the corruption, that it should have been handled in secret. They should have arranged for Jerry Dias to retire, and I don't know what other, you know, arrangements they might have made, but
from the one making the report to that effect, right?
Yeah, and he believes that it should all have been kept behind closed doors, and that the members of Unit 4 should never have found out about it. I think it's a very damning position that he's taking, and I don't think that very many members of Unit 4 would agree with that. I think that they think that the biggest problem is that not enough has been revealed, not enough has been investigated. The fact that this is being treated as though it's an isolated incident without understanding how it could have come about and what the broader structural and culture problems are within the union that could allow this sort of thing to happen. That's what the members would like to see. And even the members of my local 222, at a membership meeting, voted to send a letter to the leadership of Unit 4 saying the investigation has not gone far enough and there are too many questions left unanswered.
The word isolated came up. The report, on previous interviews with you and also Sid Ryan, it's been observed that, you know, it's been really a revelation. There is a lot of information, but the investigation itself actually is quite narrow. Ordinarily, someone who reads the Globe and the Star would be more interested in, well, there's a bunch of other people here involved in this transaction. Shouldn't somebody talk about them? And also, are we certain that this is a one-off, that this was something that just happened one day?
One of the things that the letter from Local 222 said is, you can't say it's an isolated incident unless you've investigated to find out if it was isolated or not. And that was not done. It's very clear in reading through the investigator's report that the only people spoken to were a very small handful of senior Unit 4 staff that were directly involved. They did not talk to other Unit 4 staff. They did not ask who else was promoting the sale of the test kits. They didn't ask what other companies bought test kits as a result of the recommendations. They didn't talk to anybody from the company that supplied the test kits. And they didn't even consider what the quid pro quo might have been for the whole arrangement. If Jerry Dias, who's the national president of Unit 4, goes to companies that bargain with Unit 4 and asks them to do something, asks them to buy something, what are they expecting in return? Are they going to say, yeah, we're going to buy, you know, $1 million of this product, Jerry, but you're going to owe us? I mean, isn't that a reasonable assumption or consideration? I mean, shouldn't that at least be investigated? And that's the part of this whole procedure that really needs to be looked at more broadly. What is the relationship between the leadership of this union, my union, and major corporate players and political players that allows them to develop this kind of relationship? I mean, the quote in the investigation report that's attributed to Jerry Dias when he was prevailing upon Chris McDonald to take his share of the money is that Jerry said, it's good to maintain relationships with rich people, like the person who was from the company that supplied the test kits. Why is it good to maintain relationships with rich people? Doesn't that compromise the role of the union in representing its members? And I think what's really missing in this whole broader picture is, what class are the leaders of Unifor representing? What class have they been representing? When they tell members that we should have good relations with rich people, when they tell members, you know, that we have the same interests as the corporations and we should be working hand in hand, who benefits from that?
Yes. It's a far cry from the many years of, I've dealt with people who were negotiators, and some are now, and who say, you know, if they're offered something like this at a table by management, they say, no, I got my own.
Yep.
Yeah, I brought my own donut. Thank you very much.
of course, it'd be, you know, and but
way, you know, this is a history of labor. George Meany is a legendary sellout who said, well, they said, golly, George, you seem to be living pretty well. And we noticed that you're playing golf with so-and-so General Motors, who was. And he said, well, I have to show them we're equal to them, you know. I have to keep up appearances. They're very rich, so I've got to be very rich. And, I mean, it is, pathetically, kind of laughable. But there is a larger public interest. The Star had one paragraph, which I wanted to ask the writers what the paragraph is doing there, because it seems to open up a kind of big subject. It said, last December, as the Ontario, the Omicron wave prompted a scramble for rapid tests, Ontario's Minister of Government and Consumer Services issued a warning to unscrupulous businesses against the illegal resale of tests that were received free of cost from the government. I hope they are not suggesting that these might have actually been free at some point. Anyway, but you know, we do. I mean, we have the pandemic background here. This whole thing, opportunity for money to pass hands, for sales to be arranged sort of out of the ordinary, in an extraordinary way, were these panicked conditions of fighting COVID. You would think that someone would take us over into that other chapter. You mentioned the investigators know the names. They know the name of the company. They know the name of Mr. A, they know the name of Mr. B, and they know somebody, EH, a company. On the exposed and humiliated labor side of this, we know all the names and we hear all the stories. I would really like to be over on the other side, knowing the names and hearing all the stories between whoever the salesperson was and the management people were, and the quantity and quality, and then the amounts of money. I would be, you would think Canadians would say, that's the part I'd like to hear about. I understand Jerry and his problems, but why don't we hear about the other, those who are rich, and as Jerry put it, well-connected.
I agree with you. And it would, I believe, allow for greater insight into the culture of the union and how it has operated, that has ended up in a situation where all of this kind of information is kept secret. It's not shared with the members. The members don't know that this kind of stuff is going on. And yet, when it comes to bargaining, the same people who have been developing these relationships with the executives of the corporations they're bargaining with then come to the table and say, well, you know, this is the best deal we could get. The reality is that for members of Unifor, particularly in the auto industry, which I come out of, have seen nothing but losses over the last 15 years. We've seen a two-tier wage system where currently the majority of workers in Oshawa building pickup trucks are making more than $13 an hour less than the top rate, because GM was able to get rid of all of the old workforce in 2019 and turn around a year later and hire all new workers. And under a collective agreement that the leadership of Unifor has accepted and advocated that the members vote for, that has this two-tier system in it. And then you find out about this kind of dealing going on and bags of money being exchanged. And of course, members are asking, was there any of that involved with our negotiations? Mm-hmm. And they remember that when corruption was uncovered in the UAW, dealing with the same companies, GM, Ford, and Stellantis, or Chrysler at the time, that when it was investigated, and it was investigated more thoroughly in the United States, because it was being investigated by the feds there, and they uncovered testimony that the corporate executives were very willing to splash around millions of dollars to top leaders of the unions, because they said they knew that they could keep them fat, dumb, and happy and get the concessions they wanted in bargaining.
What's those three words here? Fat, what, and happy?
Fat, dumb, and happy.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. And when we look at the situation in Unifor and with Jerry Dias, you know, we have to look back and say about the people who are praising him now, you know, and saying, well, yes, he's made an error here, or he's, you know, but he was struggling with addiction and other problems and pressure. But look at his record. Can we really praise the record of somebody who engaged in very destructive raiding and damaged the labor movement, who tried to promote the Liberal Party provincially and federally to workers and get them lined up behind a party which does not represent their class interest, who supported Justin Trudeau and invited him to previous Unifor conventions, who supported Kathleen Wynne, and one of the key players in this investigation, the Ontario director of Unifor, Noreen Ritzvi, was on the stage when Kathleen Wynne launched her re-election campaign a few years ago. These are not actions which have benefited the members of Unifor, haven't benefited the working class in this country, haven't benefited the labor movement. So the people who are praising Jerry Dias now are self-deluded, or else they're people like Flavio Volpe. And I think we mentioned this before, that you know, when the first charges against Dias were released, Flavio Volpe jumped to his defense and said what a great job he was doing. And yet Flavio Volpe represents the owners, corporate owners of auto parts companies. You know, so his praise has got to be a little suspect.
Yes. It's extraordinary that because of the origins, there's been this public statement by four former leaders, two elected, and two former staff. Their position is, we had a great vision, we did wonderful things, and we had this little problem. I spoke to Sid Ryan about this last week, he made many same points. He said, well, you left the CLC. I mean, first you raided. You also, he told the story of how the Honorable Senator Youssef was put into office in Ottawa. And shortly after, he was asked whether or not Unifor could raid. The question came before Unifor, before the CLC, about the raiding. And he said, oh, yes, that's permissible. Of course, that one blew up in his face. But that was Sid's story. That where was this vision they were talking about? Where did it go off the rails?
That's right. And the problem with the people who are trying to treat this as an isolated incident is that they're not coming to grips with the problems that have really damaged the Unifor as an institution and not benefited its members and also damaged the labor movement. And if you can't come to grips with what those problems are, then they're not going to be corrected. And evidence that they're not going to be corrected, I noticed today that at the Unifor convention, which is coming up, that one of the keynote speakers is going to be the federal liberal minister of labor.
Oh boy.
You know,
well,
so they have
that's continuity.
That's continuity. And it's not just Jerry Dias. I mean, it goes back at least to Buzz Hargrove and his coziness with corporate leaders like Jerry Schwartz and Frank Stronach of Magna and the horrible deal that Buzz negotiated with Magna, that they would Magna would allow CAW to represent Magna workers, but they would assign a no strike pledge, you know, the most anti-union agreement that is imaginable, and putting a union jacket on Paul Martin. I mean, this betrayal of working class interests goes back a ways. It's not just Jerry Dias, but Jerry Dias has certainly promoted the same approach. And whoever the next leader of Unifor is, the next leadership group, if they don't accept that those are problems, then I don't think that they're going to be very successful at fixing them.
Yeah. Well, let's put this in the context of Canadian labor, Canadian Labor Congress. I saw this letter, and the only name I remember from it is Jim Stanford, but there are other names, talking about how political, they were politically advanced, yet you just described endorsing liberals. And I'm remembering that his last day in office, the Honorable Senator Hassan Youssef, there was a motion to at the Canadian Labor Congress to endorse the New Democratic Party, and he tried to prevent it.
Yes, that's true.
Maybe it was that one wonderful thing that got him in the Senate.
Yeah, well, probably many things over the course of his career.
Hail Mary from Hassan Youssef. There's a wrapping in the flag thing here. One of the things that this letter from the four says is that other unions didn't have the chutzpah because they were tied to the U.S. But where the heck have I haven't seen any heroic breakthrough ideologically for workers emanate from these guys who are all wrapped in flags.
No, and the problem is that it's waving a Canadian flag for show, but by tying themselves to the Liberal Party, they're tying themselves to a party which is servile to the American government and foreign policy interests. So it isn't very independent in that sense, and they are isolating themselves from workers in other countries, including in the United States, Mexico, and around the world. And we saw that when Jerry Dias and the leadership of Unifor, during the fight with GM over the closure of my plant in Oshawa, where they thought that the way to conduct that campaign was to ask Canadians not to purchase vehicles assembled in Mexico. Which is really nothing more than an attack on Mexican workers. So instead of trying to build ties with workers in the United States and Mexico and other countries to develop common strategies, build solidarity, work together against corporate efforts to divide them. They took the bourgeois nationalist approach, the capitalist nationalist approach of attacking workers in other countries and saying that that's how they were going to defend Canadians. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work.
Certainly not. I mean, by the way, even within the country, you have fellow members of UNIFOR who are in Quebec. They don't have a tier system there because they back a party that that made it illegal to have a tier system.
Well, that's right.
And in English Canada, they back a party that makes it legal to have a tier system.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's right. Well said. You know, if our standard is what will benefit workers and what will advance the working class movement, then we have to be for solidarity with workers in Quebec. We have to be for solidarity with workers in the United States and Mexico and around the world. And we can't take our lead from governments who have different class interests, which means the Canadian government and the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And the UNIFOR leadership, like the CAW leadership before it, at least in more recent years, has not shown that kind of understanding and commitment to workers. And as a result, workers have suffered. You know, the conditions in the plants and the wages have deteriorated. New workers don't have secure pensions anymore. They have a type of RSP, which is insecure and is very inferior to what existed before. And there's been no recognition that that's not a problem. There's been no determined effort to change it. I remember when Bob White articulated very clearly that if the union wanted members to support the union's initiative on broader political issues, they first had to deliver for the workers at the shop floor. They had to show that they were fighting and winning stuff for the workers before they ever talked about anything more broadly political. That was, you know, Bob White's clear direction to people, and he followed it. And you know, I can say during my working life as a GM worker, our collective agreements were all about gains that we made each year. In 1987, the first bargaining when we became a Canadian union, we achieved indexing of pensions to inflation, which GM at the time said they would pull out of Canada if we achieved that. But we achieved it, and they didn't pull out of Canada, and a lot of workers benefited. Well, in 2007, that was ended. And retirees in the auto industry have not had one penny of increase in their pensions in 15 years. And so then are you going to turn around and as, you know, as a union and say, yeah, we want you to back us and we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to vote for Kathleen Wynne and, you know, we're going to applaud for Justin Trudeau. But they haven't seen any reason to feel that the union has been fighting for them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very striking. When I think about it, I'm not hearing actually from any of the candidates anything about such matters as the pension. They don't run on these things. They don't say, hey, we're going to do something about those pensions.
No, they don't say that they're going to improve pensions. They don't say that they're going to get rid of the two-tier system. And that's what needs to be done before anything else is done. If you want to have the support of the members and if you want to be able to organize workers, the way that the labor movement is going to grow is if workers see that unions are fighting and achieving gains and helping them to organize. And rating doesn't accomplish that. and agreeing to concessions with corporations and supporting concessions when they're asking for more money from government doesn't cut it. And it's not going to lead to Unifor being able to organize Amazon workers. Continue to fail at organizing workers at Toyota or Honda, but they don't want to recognize why they have failed, which means that they won't be able to succeed.
Yeah. Here we have the word solidarity still being used, but there is nobody saying they're going to return to the Canadian Labour Congress or join the OFL, rejoin it. And by the way, one of the things that Sid said in the interview we did with him is that, you know, the OFL and the CLC, they didn't turn it into a bloody war. They're very polite about it. They allowed uniform members to remain at district labor councils for more than a year. You would think there's
even worse than that. They allowed Hassan Youssef and Chris Buckley to maintain leadership of the CLC and the OFL for several years after Unifor pulled out of the labor movement, by the little pretext of saying, oh, I've got a union card from some other union. That should never have been allowed. That's outrageous.
Yes. And by the way, Sid's formulation was critical of the CLC and others, because you can't really raise the banner of solidarity or use the word unless you're practically working to make it happen. So you would think that a candidate would say, you know, there are other workers in Canada. And by the way, there's thousands of unorganized, but there's also many outstanding unions. By the way, Sid pointed out that CUPED has recruited many new members, much more than Unifor. And Unifor actually gives itself a little pat on the back when they can't stay up with the others. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you the last word. You think are you anticipating a healthy outcome? Because it's going to be a kind of a messy situation.
In terms of the election for the Unifor election for national president, I'm not sure what the result is going to be. I think it's going to be a major step backward if Scott Doherty is elected. But I don't know how to assess the probability at that happening at this point. But in the broader sense of recognizing what the more deep-seated problems are within the union, I don't have a great deal of confidence at this point. I don't think that any of the candidates have done enough to really uncover what the roots of the problems are or make the kind of commitments that are needed to transform the union into an organization which is much more of a working class fighting organization. But I think that there are certainly more signs of opposition and rank and file interest and engagement than we've had before. So from that point of view, having an election campaign is certainly a healthy development.
Yeah. Well, Tony Leah, thank you very much. It's certainly it's going to be a dramatic moment in labor history. Thank you very, very much. This is the Taylor Report. See you next week.